Philema, Coast to Coast, number 9, July 15, 2005. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to another episode of Philema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow and I'm the host of the show. I want to first welcome the new listeners coming from iTunes. I've seen the download numbers jump with the release of iTunes 4.9, and I want to make sure those listening know I appreciate their support. Today's show will have very little of me talking. First, I have a 10-minute interview with Keith418. We continue our exploration of transparency in the Philemic community. Then I have a 40-minute interview with author Eric Davis. Eric has written a book in the 33 and a third series about Led Zeppelin's album Zeppelin IV. In it, he explores the esoteric and occult meaning of the songs in the album artwork. In the interview, we talk about a few of the songs and some of the meanings of the album's artwork. I'll be ending the podcast with a song from a group called The Alchemist Element. I found their music on GarageBand.com. They sound a lot like Tool, so I hope many listeners will like them. Anyway, let's get into the interview with Keith418.
Hello, Keith. Are you there?
Yeah, 93, John.
Hey, 93. Welcome to the podcast. I was wondering if we could expand a little more on transparency. I don't think we spent enough time on it because it's really an important subject to address in the Philemic community.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, I think that, you could do a whole 3-hour podcast talking about transparency issues, and that still probably wouldn't do it justice. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about some of the debates that have come up about transparency lately is the sort of cluelessness people are evidencing regarding the whole concept of learning from mistakes. I mean, you can't learn from somebody's mistake if you don't have the data to know what they did. And if you look, like, over the last 20 years of OTO history, there have been bodies open and closed left and right. There have been bodies that have had real problems. There are bodies that have never worked. And this is something that if we have egos and we have some confidence in ourselves, we should be able to look at soberly and in a very objective and, you know, intent on examining the problems these bodies had sort of way. And what I find fascinating is that people don't sort of understand the learning from mistakes part of transparency. If a body collapses, other body members will not know what mistakes they may have made that led to that collapse unless the information is shared and people get on the same page. And even if you and I disagree about the reasons for a body's failure or collapse, we can at least have an intelligent discussion where you can be aware of my perspectives, and I can be aware of yours, and we can also look at the facts and get on the same page when it comes to what actually happened. And the OTO does not seem to be an agency or, you know, an organization that is intent on learning from its own mistakes. And I blame the leaders when it comes to this, because they are the people who are supposed to be modeling the kind of behavior they want to see. And we do not see them saying, hey, everybody, let's look at our mistakes and learn from them. Instead, they rush past the scene of the crime, they rush past the accident, and nothing to see here, nothing to look at, we're moving on. And consequently, I think you'll see people keep making the same mistakes over and over again. You don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. People can learn from each other's mistakes, people should be able to learn from their own mistakes. And I think our leaders really need to start directing the culture around towards a transparent and let's learn from our mistakes model rather than a complete opacity and we never talk about our mistakes because we want to pretend like we never made them. This is crazy.
One of the things that we do at my business is at the end of a project, we do a post-mortem examination of how the project went. We talk about the things that went right on the project. We talked about the things that went wrong, what we could improve, what processes as we were going through the project that we did, because you just don't do a examination at the beginning when you do a fact-finding and requirements gathering, and then a post-mortem. You should do it all the way through the process, reevaluation and milestones and so forth. And when you're doing that, you can notice problems and make adjustments. And then at the end, you look back and say, okay, how did those work? What did we do wrong? What room do we have for improvement? And one of the things that is really important in that kind of post-mortem examination is not finger-pointing, not saying, you screwed up and did this, you screwed up and did that. And it's more of a team effort. And so we have to say, okay, as a team, we could have done better doing X, or we did great doing Y.
But
let's
there's going to have to be a certain amount of personal accountability within that. And I think that what's interesting is that I think our, you know, our leaders and many of the people involved in the organization routinely follow that sort of post-mortem examination of goals and projects in other aspects of their lives, usually on the job.
Yes.
So why do they have such a hard time applying the same sort of analysis and rigor to the OTO? I mean, Crowley said, the method of science, the aim of religion. Well, transparency and looking at facts and being able to look at trends and studying numbers is part of what scientists do. And that information has to be available to all the scientists who are working on a project in order for it to work. Transparency is part of the scientific revolution. You know, you can't keep certain scientific secrets secret for very long, especially if they're extremely important. And people in the OTO don't seem to grasp the connection between learning from mistakes, transparency, getting the information out there, and then some level of personal accountability based on that. And to me, I think people often use the lack of transparency as a way to dodge accountability and protect each other, their friends, or whatnot. And, it, you know, that's not what you do in a serious organization. I mean, if we were all very seriously bent on creating a purposeful, strong, goal-oriented, achieving OTO, there'd be no way we wouldn't want every single fact available so that we could use it to not make mistakes and to go forward.
One of the examples on how transparency in this kind of environment or an environment of opacity hurts is what's going on in the U.S. FDA. Right now, the FDA needs drug companies to do the trials and to do the examinations of their drugs to determine if there are any problems. Well, what happens is the studies that come out from the drug companies are always positive. The studies that they perform that are not positive, they never release the data. Not only that, they don't have to tell when they're doing the various examinations or trials until they're complete, so that people don't even know that they're doing it.
Right. But the irony here, John, is that people in the OTO routinely see problems in transparency in the U.S. government. They push for the Freedom of Information Act. They argue for transparency and sunshine laws. But when it comes to the OTO, the same people with the same values turn around and suddenly think, oh, that doesn't apply to us. And it seems very weird to me how they can compartmentalize something as important as transparency when it comes to drug laws and drug research, and then turn around and say, we don't have to have transparency in this other realm. I mean, to me, it shows that they don't really take the OTO seriously, because if they did, they would want it to be successful. And if they wanted it to be successful, they'd want to learn from their mistakes. And if they wanted to learn from their mistakes, they would want it to be as transparent as it possibly could be. We've seen already that there's a disagreement among some of the people in the order whether the organization is transparent at all. Some people say it already is transparent. Others say that it's not and needs to be more so. There's not even a general understanding there. So the chaos just continues to grow and grow. Who is going to sort through this and say, this is where we're going, here are the facts, this is what we need to do, and get everybody to the point where they're all at least, if they're not in agreement, they all have the information to have a reasonable discussion.
Well, we also get into the problems of various people at various levels in the hierarchy. Some are for some degree of transparency, and others are against it altogether, and some are for complete openness. And so you also have that internal politics of what data should be released and what shouldn't. For instance, I've been to meetings where I've had discussions with OTO officers that One officer thinks, oh yeah, we should totally put this data out that we collect from the local bodies. And then another officer thinks, no, that should never be released at all. And even saying, you know, that they have some sort of expectation of privacy or something of that nature. And so there's no leadership kind of pulling this all together and saying, this is how we're going to handle it. This is how we're setting up a culture of transparency. This is what is transparent. And these are the things that aren't. These are our, quote, trade secrets, and these are our financials, and they're public, and this is our administrative data, and this is public, and this is our initiation rituals, and these are not public. And, I mean, it's not an all-or-nothing situation. They
no,
could definitely
many,
set it up.
There's many shades here, but what we keep seeing is a lack of understanding as to whether the group is transparent or not, and an understanding of what transparency is and is not. And then a kind of lack of understanding about whether things should be or should not be transparent within that context. And, I mean, for me, one of the biggest problems I have with the way the organization is structured right now is that it's impossible to train people or to hold people accountable on information they don't have. You can't train an accountant unless you let them see the books. You can't train people to hold the numbers as being important in some way if you don't have the numbers or you won't let them look at them. And I don't think people quite always realize just how in the dark a lot of OTO decisions are made sometimes. People, you know, just don't have that much information to go on. And consequently, the rate of failure we see for the smaller bodies isn't surprising. I mean, how can they be expected to succeed if they're never given any information about what works and what doesn't? A lot of people are going to say that the policy is the organization's memory for failure and for success, that the things that work out well become policy, the things that don't work are forbidden by policy. But policy is a poor substitute for transparency and for a hands-on training with certain situations. I would never try to train staff people at a nonprofit or any job if I couldn't give them the relevant information. So how do we train people now if no one really knows what's going on?
Well, I think this also gets into communication. But and maybe communication is a good place to start on the next podcast, but we need to wrap up this discussion of transparency today. And before we go, though, we should encourage the listeners to really look at the Thelemic organizations they're in and look at the level of transparency and accountability that are in the organizations compared to the kind of transparencies and that they see around them, whether it's private corporations, public corporations, government, nonprofits, or any kind of group that they're involved in, and compare the level of transparency in those groups to those in the Thelemic groups that they're in.
And also, you know, is that transparency helping them in other parts of their lives, and is it the lack of it hurting them in the organization? And I think that's what they need to look at, too. But I think that's a very good point.
All right. Well, we'll wrap this one up, and then maybe in the next podcast we'll talk about communication and its connection to transparency. But thanks for being on the show, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me, 93.
93.
Eric Davis is a San Francisco-based writer, culture critic, and independent scholar. His book Technosis, Myth, Magic, and Mysticism in the Age of Information was released by Harmony Books in fall of 1998. Davis is a contributing writer for Wired magazine, and his essays have appeared in over a dozen books, including Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, The Disinformation Book of Lies, Prefiguring Cyberculture, and Paul DJ Spooky Miller's Sound Unbound. Davis has taught in the California Institute of Integral Studies, the New York Open Center, and ESALEN, and is one of the organizers of Planet Work, a conference on information technology and the global ecology held in San Francisco in 2000. As I stated before, in this interview we discuss his newest book about Zeppelin IV and its occult meaning. Here's the interview.
We have on the phone with us Eric Davis, the author of the book about Zeppelin IV from the 33 and a third series. Are you there, Eric?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
To start off, let's start looking at Zeppelin IV. Why did you choose Zeppelin IV, and what about the album makes it such a compelling album to write about?
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I decided to write one of these, try to pitch one of these books about a rock record, and I decided I wanted to write about Led Zeppelin because I loved Led Zeppelin when I was a teenager, and I still listen to them and I still love them. But unlike most really, really huge and influential bands, very little has been written about them that's very intelligent. There's a lot of fan bios and, you know, good histories of the band, or not even always so good histories of the band, but there's been very little that sort of takes them more seriously, if you want to say, uses a more critical language, or goes into the mythology and the mytho-poetic power of the band very intensely. So I felt like I almost kind of owed it to them, given all the power and pleasure they had given me over the years. And it was kind of interesting deciding on that record, because it's not my favorite Led Zeppelin record. I would say that Led Zeppelin 3 is my favorite record, although a slightly edited form of Physical Graffiti might also take that place. But I wrote about Led Zeppelin 4 basically because I had a very peculiar and marvelous experience a couple of years ago. I was in England with a friend, and we were going to go from London down to Cornwall. And so we were driving, and we didn't have any music with us, and it was a boring drive along the freeway. And so we stopped in one of the, a gas station, and they had those overpriced cassettes, and they were all just, you know, whatever, new crap, pop stuff, but then they had Led Zeppelin 4, and I went, hey, this will be fun. I haven't heard this in a couple of years or whatever. So I bought the cassette, and then we decided to take another way and go through Glastonbury, which I had never been through before, which is this center of mysticism and magic. It's sort of like the New Age Mecca of England these days, and it has this long occult history and relations with Avalon, and there's this mystic well there, et cetera, et cetera. So, and, you know, it's sometimes identified as the Isle of Avalon. Anyway, so we're driving along, and then, like, just as we're kind of approaching Glastonbury, there's this really tall hill called the Tor. It's very peculiar looking. It looks kind of like an artificial barrow mound, but it is a natural formation. And it was like sunset, and just as we were driving along, like Battle for Evermore was fading out and Stairway to Heaven was starting. And I had this reverie, I guess you'd have to call it. This totally intense experience of enchantment, and it brought back all of this magic feelings that I had when I was a kid, when I was listening to this music, and it was so powerful and so transportive, and it would take me places. And I just, like, had this kind of amazing, intense connection, like, through this English landscape, this mystical English landscape, into the kind of, like, mystical English heart of this music. And it really just kind of blew me away. And in a way, what I wanted to do is to go back into that feeling, but use my, you know, adult analytic skills with my understanding of music and production technology and the history of the occult and, you know, how popular music works, and use all those kind of tools to try to flesh out a much deeper kind of emotional experience that I had with that record that obviously, well, on some level, millions of other people have had more or less, that there's some very powerful kind of emotional, transportive quality to that music, as well as it's just being like fun ass-kicking music or good stuff to throw on when you're making out or smoking bong loads or whatever, you know, the other things that people use it for. It's also powerfully imaginative material, and I wanted to go into that imagination.
I've had some very similar experiences with Zeppelin music, and Zeppelin music has definitely been one of the influencing factors that got me involved in the occult. What kind of obvious occult overtones are seen in Zeppelin 4? I mean, obviously the cover and some of the messages, Battle of Evermore is very Tolkien-oriented and so forth. What are some of the more obvious ones that people would find of an occult overtone?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, just before answering the question directly is a little bit about how just in your experience, you talked about how this is one of the ways you got into the occult, is that in my book I talk about how it's a little bit like a gateway drug into the esoteric. But like, how does that actually work? You're listening to music, it moves you, it's really powerful, it seems kind of enchanted, it seems kind of mysterious, but what do? You know, you start talking to people, and then you hear rumors, and there's this process of learning to read the deeper meanings of the band. And so, like, you know, when I was in high school, I'd find, you know, there was the rumor that they had sold their soul to the devil, which is this, you know, kind of cartoon story. And then you, like, read a little bit more, and you find out, you know, Jimmy Page owned this house that belonged to some guy named Crowley or Crowley or whatever that was, and then you find out a little bit more about that. So the music, its mystique, its mystery, draws you in, and that's part of the whole phenomenon of the occult, is that it it gives you these sort of seductive little clues, but you don't really know what it is, and so you keep going farther and farther and deeper in order to, like, follow the thread. So Led Zeppelin 4, just the packaging of it alone, is this brilliant gesture towards mystique and mystery. So it's like, you know, it's this record that's, you know, millions of copies of this thing have gone out there. It was super mainstream, totally pop, you know, Britney Spears, except in the rock context. And yet, it's totally mysterious. Doesn't have, by taking their name or any writing off of the cover, it turns it into this weird, you know, icon that you don't know what it means. And you're kind of drawn in, who is this weird old dude there? And, you know, it's, the outside of the record is all about the contrast between the old guy on the cover who's carrying some sticks, maybe it's for a bonfire or something, and then you see the modern world on the back of the cover. But then you open it up, and you see this, you know, image that, even if you don't know where it comes from, clearly has this kind of occult quality, but it's this, the figure from the tarot card, from the Hermit. And, you know, that's all pretty weird and mysterious, but, you know, kind of generic, mid-70s sort of mystic stuff. There's a lot of mysticism in the kind of pop objects in the mid-70s. And then you pull out the inner sleeve, and there's these mysterious symbols. And I really think it's the mysterious symbols that indicate to people that if there's kind of going to be a mainstream rock record that is tapped into deeper forces, it's going to be this record or, you know, this band. And I think the symbols have a lot to do with really, you know, kind of enchanting the music already. So all this stuff is happening before you even put the record on, before you even start listening to the tunes, some of which I think are very, as you say, kind of overtly, if not a cult, mystical or sort of mythopoetic, and many of which are not, although in what I do for in my book about it is really try to weave all the songs together as the sort of story of one person's spiritual journey, which is the kind of, you know, motif I have in it. But, you know, in that course of those eight songs, there are a couple that really pop out, as you say, Battle for Evermore, Stairway to Heaven, and, you know, to a lesser extent, other songs. But I think they all run through the same kind of thread of mystery and enchantment that kind of draws you in a little bit farther.
It always struck me that the album itself was some kind of talisman, and the symbols themselves were kind of what tied it to the actual members, but then, you know, you're still holding it in your hand.
Absolutely.
What are those four symbols? I've read a lot about how each one was chosen and how each one was assigned to a different member of the band, and the most mysterious is obviously Page's Zoso symbol. What kind of background did you find out about each of the symbols and the meaning behind them?
Right. Well, you know, as you say, it's there's a lot written about it. It's one of the most obvious. You know, it's kind of the holy grail of Zeppelore. Are these mysterious symbols, and, you know, it doesn't take too long to find out most of the information. I mean, there's a lot of, like, you know, fantasy out there, a lot of projection, a lot of, like, crazy, marvelous ideas that are people throwing that way. But it basically seems to coming down to, like, Page went, okay, and I, you know, I'm not sure this is exactly how it happened, but more or less, Page went, okay, we're going to do this. He gave this book of insignia, which were, many of them were quite mystic, but the book itself was a book for designers. Came out in the, like, 1930s by a guy named Koch. And it was, you know, just for, like, people doing typeface and graphics. But it had a lot of symbols from the Middle Ages and from, you know, later times with some of their descriptions involved. So, you know, John Paul Jones picked his and John Bonham picked his. And, you know, you can sort of interpret the symbols based on certain things. And then, you know, Plant and Page kind of came up with their own. Plant's, I think, it's pretty clear that it comes from a Churchwald book on the lost continent of Mu, although the image of the feather itself is most likely the feather of Mott. So it's an image of not just of kind of poetry and writing, but of judgment, of the kind of final judgment in the Egyptian cosmology. And the you know, the Zosa figure is the most mysterious, the one that has the most fantasy about it. It's the most enigmatic. But it's pretty clear that it comes down to there's a 16th century glyph by Kardak that's more or less the same, that signifies Capricorn, Saturn, signifies Saturn, which is valuable because Page himself was a Capricorn. And then in Le Dragon Rouge, which is a black magic text that probably was compiled and written in the early 19th century in France, although it ascribes to itself a much older origin, as is the way with such texts. In that book, you will find, which was reprinted about 10 years ago, you can find basically the same glyph that we see in the inner sleeve. So there's ultimately not too much mystery about it. One thing about Jimmy Page is he was very, very good at sampling other people and hiding his tracks. One could say that less generously is that he swiped a lot of people. He swiped a lot of tunes. There's musical things that he did as well, which we could talk about. But so it's kind of actually fitting and a little bit funny that this great mysterious symbol that you imagine the guitarist staying up late at night, you know, invoking things, drawing his own sigils and some kind of Austin Osmond Spare kind of thing. He actually just kind of lifted it from, you know, one of the rare books that he owns. But it's an appropriate symbol. But the other thing about the symbols that nobody talked about, which I think is actually kind of true, is that they map very, very clearly, for the most part, onto the four elements. If you look at them, you know, the base elements are the sinking elements, water and earth, John Paul Jones and John Bonham. John Bonham's symbol is all discs, like in the tarot in tarot. John Paul Jones's symbol have these sort of cup shapes, the three cup shapes that overlap each other. So we got, you know, water and earth there. Then you have the feather, clearly a symbol of air, and then the, you know, obviously Page is the fire sign, so it's just, you know, looks the most like some kind of fiery glyph. So I think that's actually a pretty decent reading. I don't know if they were thinking about it, but it works out on that kind of mystical level, and it makes sense because in a way this is the fourth record by a quartet, and it's their great work. It's the one that has their biggest song on it, which is also the fourth song on the record. And it sells the most copies. This is it. You know, that's the one they made that, you know, is for the history books. And so I think there really is some kind of alchemical kind of process going on there. Again, how conscious they were of it is almost beside the point. I mean, those were heady days, and they were inspired gents, very young men. But it doesn't really matter in a way because there are deeper forces going on.
Let's look at some of the occult symbolism in the songs. And you can pick any song you want to start with.
Well, let's see. If we're going to pick any song, I'd probably start with the first song because that's the record that starts, the song that starts the record. And it's also the one that if you listen to it, you know, most people who listen to it do not think of it as having, you know, anything very kind of mystic or occult in it, with the possible exception of the title, which is kind of mysterious, which we might as well sort of, you know, begin there.
Okay.
You're like Black Dog, okay, whatever. You know, I never really paid attention to it until I started looking at it more deeply. Why do they call this thing a Black Dog? And in the official story that Plant gives at one point is that there was this black Labrador that was hanging around Headley Grange, which is the sort of isolated 18th century manor where they recorded the record. You know, and he would keep coming into the studio, and they weren't really sure, so they named the song after him, which is, well, that's okay. It's an okay story, although...
One addition, I heard in one interview that I thought he said it was a three-legged dog.
Hmm. I have not heard that detail.
Maybe I'm misremembering that, but I thought that was during some of the... remember when the Zeppelin box set came out?
Yes.
And they were doing all of those interviews on MTV. I remember Plant talking about that at one point, and I have a vague recollection that it was a three-legged dog.
I love that. It makes it a little bit more enchanted because then it's only one step away from the three-headed dog of Cerberus. but in any case, it's a little hard to imagine these guys like basically even like leaving the doors open. It's like it's the pit of winter. It was a particularly cold winter, I found out. So it's unlikely that they were just kind of leaving the doors open for, like, wandering beasts to kind of drag their sopping, you know, fur into the studio. But, you know, be that as it may, what comes out that's more interesting is the figure of the black dog. Black dogs have a powerful lore attached to them in England. The Hound of the Baskervilles, that Sherlock Holmes story, is only the tip of the iceberg. And they are often seen, they often have red glowing eyes. They're seen all over, and there's a lot of interesting lore about them, both historically and mythically. They're associated with death, with disasters. They probably arise from the encounter of the inhabitants of England with the invading Vikings and, you know, Norwegians, that they saw as being sort of hounds or devil dogs. And so then the figure of the devil dog sort of stays inside of lore, is almost this kind of a kind of mythological figure for a invading force, or, you know, almost like Immigrant Song. And so there's, you know, sightings today of black dogs, that they have this kind of spooky quality. And of course, that going back even farther, the whole relationship of the dog is a psychopomp to the underworld. Whether you have, you know, Cerberus is the great example. There's others in Egyptian lore, others in Germanic lore. There's something about this wolf-dog figure as an intermediary between our world and the other world, almost a kind of crossroads figure. And it's in that crossroads figure that we encounter it in the history of rock music, and particularly in blues, because that's where you get to this you know, the spookiest blues song of all time, you know, and the song Black Dog is a mutant blues. Spookiest blues song of all time is Hellhound on My Trail. So you have that figure of the hellhound right there at the core, the sort of inspirational core of the whole blues tradition, that great Robert Johnson tune. Get that whole figure of the crossroads, of that swap, you know, that devil swap. So it's a mythic trace that lies right inside the music, and you can also, in the book, I won't go into it now, but in the book I actually trace it through some of the way that the song is actually constructed musically, as well as some of the lyrics about, you know, eyes are wide burning red, dreams of you all through my head. It's a song of haunting, not just of lust, which it might look like on one level, but of a kind of deeper sort of haunting. That really opens up the record. It's that passage across the threshold that enters you into the story of the record.
All right, well, let's move on to rock and roll then.
You want to go through them all singly?
Well, okay. Actually, it doesn't seem to me that rock and roll has a lot of... It just seems, you know, kind of in your face, very hard, and, you know...
Oh, yeah, the music on that is great. I mean, the whole point about this stuff is not that everything accords with some kind of scheme, because if that was the case, it wouldn't be very interesting. It wouldn't be very powerful. The whole thing that makes it interesting, and this is what makes mysticism in popular culture, when it works, it's not because they're like, we are a very mystical band, we make very mystical music, and all our lyrics are that's not very interesting. It's like there's 1,000 goth bands that try to do that, and very rarely do they make any interesting kind of music. What's cool is when you take all the other stuff that's going on in rock and roll or popular music, just, you know, can't, you know, whatever, lollipop lust and fast cars and being, you know, mad at your mom and all the stuff that goes into rock music, and interweaving it with this other stuff, with this sort of mystical tendencies or these mythic qualities, and it's the mixture of them that make it so great, and it's the mixture of those things that make Led Zeppelin great. If they were just doing the Battle for Evermore songs or the epic songs, it wouldn't work. You need the whole lot of love. You need, you know, Communication Breakdown. You need these kind of crass blues songs. It's the mixture that makes it so enchanting and so appealing. It's like in the idea of alchemy, where you're like, you're throwing all the stuff in there, and then out of that you're making something. You're making a kind of higher form of it. It's like there's all this muck in there. So sure, they have like a total, they have actually in some ways their most pure and innocent song is rock and roll, and their whole, or the one that's the most just like totally from when that you could just imagine them being like 13 years old and being totally jazzed by first listening to rock music. That said, the lyrics are a little bit more interesting than they might appear at first, and you know I kind of play with that. But if we're going to be talking about the you know mythopoetic stuff, it's really in you know Battle for Evermore and Stairway to Heaven. And,
well, then let's move on to Battle of Evermore. Now that's obviously a Tolkien reference, and you know that's not the first song that had that with Ramble On talking about Gollum and so forth.
But, yeah. Yeah, there's three Zep songs that they explicitly allude to the Lord of the Rings and Misty Mountain Hop on Lesbian Four is the other one. Ramble On, and in many ways I think is the kind of seed crystal of all of Led Zeppelin Four. It sets out a lot of the themes and a lot of the energy that I think they take forward just because it's called Ramble On. I mean, what really unites all the songs on Led Zeppelin Four is this theme of wandering. He's in every song, Plant talks about wandering, about moving, or about doing the stroll, about climbing, about fleeing, about going to Chicago, going to California. It's all about traveling, restless movement, which is of course always also a journey of the spirit. But in Battle of Evermore, that's a very dense, very rich, very kind of nuanced song in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of things that are going on it, not least of which is the presence of Sandy Denny, the only time there's a female vocalist on any kind of you know conventional Led Zeppelin track until you get to sort of later stuff, post John Bonham. And that's not insignificant. If you look on the inner sleeve of the record again, you find that Sandy Denny, the woman who sang that, who was from a great folk combo called Fairport Convention, she had just left the band when she did this recording, she gets her own little symbol that is also from that Koch book that I talked about earlier. And it's this sort of these three little triangles pointing downwards, and it's very much a sign of the... It says in the book that it's a sign of the Godhead, and if you look at it with its little yoni-like triangles, it looks very much like a symbol of the triple goddess. And if you listen to what she's actually singing in the song, it's pretty much a kind of pagan call. You know, in a lot of ways, the song is about how the rituals of the earth rituals of the of you know a pagan culture are what sustain us, and that in relation to that, in the midst of this, these dark forces are arising. It's unclear exactly who this dark lord is, though. It's actually a very enigmatic song. It's not really clear whose side who is on, but it's definitely an apocalyptic battlescape with all sorts of forces in the heavens as well as in the earth. And it's a you know it's an incredibly beautiful and enchanting song as well.
It definitely seems to me that it is talking about the everlasting battle between good and evil. I mean, even the name Evermore, this battle that's eternal, even kind of evokes some kind of Ragnarok kind of concept too.
Very much, it very much has that Ragnarok feel. But it's a little unclear what happens with this dragon who's blinded by the sun, and you're like, wait, how? Why would a dragon be blind? You know, who's a fire-breathing dragon, presumably be blinded by the sun? And it's actually kind of unclear when you try to imagine, like, just like looking at it on the as a text. It's pretty clear what's going on, and which I think is great. It's totally it's a deep enigma, and it's also their most sort of explicitly British song in the sense that it sounds like British folk rock, and more than almost anything else they did. They did a lot of folk stuff, but a lot of the folk or the acoustic music that they did really draws more from America. But here they really, when they had this folk rock singer with them too, they were really drawing from the matter of Britain. And that's part of the power of the record, especially for those of us on the other side of the pond, is that they gave us a way to kind of imagine and be enchanted by a Northern European story, particularly a British one, but it's really more that there's a sort of Northern European vibe, the same thing you find in the Immigrant Song, and that's part of what strikes people it's a kind of, you know, for many a sort of in the mainstream world a little dangerous topic. But I think it's definitely part of their mythopoetic powers that they were able to strike a certain chord, very much the same way that Lord of the Rings did. The Lord of the Rings is so powerful partly because Tolkien explicitly wanted to create a myth of, you know, Northern European lore that would serve the function of an actual living myth for modern people. And what's great about Zeppelin and those three allusions to the Lord of the Rings is whatever they mean exactly, it's kind of unclear, although it's interesting that two of them are allusions to the dark kind of side of things. It's more that they're just showing that that's what they want to do. They want to get that big. You know, they want to make music that is the same, functions like Lord of the Rings. They're going for that level of popularity and power. And in many ways, they achieved it, particularly with this record. It's kind of remarkable, actually.
How much of the lyrics and the tapping into that Northern European, you might even say Celtic, I mean, Plant is given the credit for writing all the words of these songs by this album, and you know, he definitely had a Celtic interest, Northern European background, and whereas Page had a more kind of more occultic, hermetic background, with Plant being from the Celtic side. Do you think it was him who pulled in the Tolkien stuff, or was this a collaborative thing?
Well, you know, all we can really go on that is what they say, and they are always pretty insistent that Robert Plant writes the words, and so I'm happy to take him at that level in terms of what's actually going on. I mean, again, that's part of the mythic power of the band is the polarity between these two guys. On the one hand, a pretty retiring guy, not very above board. You know, he keeps his you know, Thoth cards close to his chest, Jimmy Page. And it creates this kind of mystique, and there's a kind of darkness there. I mean, there's definitely a kind of a sense of hidden mastery and hidden power and trafficking with forces and sort of doing things behind the scenes, you know, his whole kind of studio craft. I mean, one way of reading the fact that he put Zoso on his amps and on the sweater and his clothes or whatever is like, you'd look at it and you'd be like, he knows something I don't. You know, he develops that sense of mystique, and that's very much balanced with the far more accessible kind of hippie pagan love god vibe of Robert Plant, who's much more accessible, much more, you know, sort of generous with his energy, and draws from fluffier sources in a lot of ways in terms of his loves, musical and mythic, and he was deeply into history and Celtic stuff and all sorts of hippie lore and drew from it for his lyrics, some of which are really quite good and you know, pretty underestimated by people outside of the cult. And so it's part of it is the balance between those two guys that gives the music that extra kind of dimension, or gives the mystique that extra dimension. If it was just Jimmy Page and then just some nothing singer, it wouldn't have the same effect. So I it does seem that he was really producing a lot of that kind of Celtic energy.
That segues nicely into Stairway to Heaven, because in interviews, Plant always claims that he just sat down one night and wrote about two-thirds of Stairway to Heaven all at once.
Yes.
So why don't you talk some about Stairway to Heaven, obviously their biggest song ever.
Yeah, it's a funny song. It was the last chapter I wrote for the book. I kept saving it for last, and I talk about a lot. It's like the longest section of the book, and it's quite there's quite a lot of elements to it. But one thing to say just off the top is that story is really interesting, because whether or not he wrote it in one night or whatever, what's important about that story is that it has a quality of it being sort of channeled. And in fact, he even talks about it in terms of it was as if some force was saying, like, you know, here's a wedding song for you or whatever. Like, you guys think you're great. Yeah, well, here's the deal. And it doesn't matter whether or not that actually happened that way. It's that it's important for the power of the song, and it's important for the way the song is understood, that there is this element of sort of almost sort of transcendental transmission to it. And it really pops out on the rest from the rest of the songs on the record in all the other songs, there's this sort of character, a kind of human eye, you know, like whether it's Black Dog or Rock and Roll or Battle for Evermore, they're all waiting for the battle in the morning. There's this sort of human character who's struggling and looking for release. In Stairway to Heaven, there's not really that figure very much. It comes up a little bit here and there, but it's mostly, it has much more of a kind of objective, above the, you know, sort of bird's eye view of this scenario, this kind of visionary scenario that unfolds. And it's a very tough song to talk about because there's not one myth. It's not like it resolves to one story or it means something specific. It's almost more that it uses bits and pieces of different mythic scenarios or occult allusions or mystical sort of intuitions. And it kind of just lays them all out in this very powerful progression, musical progression, in a way that just sort of deepens its resonance without necessarily ever quite resolving what exactly it means. And it's doing that on the level of the music just as much as it's doing it on the level of the lyrics. It's always easy to talk about lyrics, but on the level of the music, you start out in this very sort of almost quote-unquote medieval or at least Renaissance space of the opening bars, and it slowly builds. And there's what I count to be five, and I think it's an important number, five sort of levels that the song goes through. You start out with the purely acoustic music, then the drum starts, then you get a second guitar, then you get this break, then you get the driving electric guitar, and then you get the final sort of grind. And what happens is that at the beginning, there's lots of different musical voices. There's counterpoint in the guitar. There's the drums over here. It's a many vocal, many voiced acoustic music. And by the end of the song, it's a driving single electric riff. It's like they go from the mythic space of the past, which is part of what draws all of us into the occult and spirituality, is this sort of nostalgia for some other way of being that we often see or read through, at least initially, through a tradition, through some pre-modern culture. And it starts out in that space of romance and nostalgia, and a lot of the lyrics are about this kind of mystic, kind of Celtic universe. But at the end, we're like driving down the road, and the road is like where we are now. The road is like this sort of plunging, increasingly integrated, electric, forceful line that's going ahead. And so they're really doing a lot, you know, with the music on that piece as well as the lyrics.
If I remember correctly from the interview, Paige just grabbed the guitar and did that solo just as a one take. I think they had the custom of doing three different solos and then picking the one they liked. And he did that one solo first, and right after they were done, they knew that was it.
Yeah, so, although the solo itself was recorded later. Like they recorded the I think, if I get this right, and I could be wrong, but I don't think so. They recorded the basic part of the song, not without the solo, at Headley Grange, and it was later in London where he overdubbed the guitar solo. But he did that in the studio in one take.
Right.
That's
right.
What I think happened. And it is a kind of remarkable, you know, remarkable. So it's remarkable in concert too. There's the thing you'll notice, that's a whole other side of them, is the way, now that there's this great double DVD, you can see a lot more than we could in The Song Remains the Same in terms of the way they performed and how hieratic they are on stage. And there's the crux of the song is that fanfare where you go from the kind of acoustic section into the electric part where Plant says, you know, your stairway lies on the whispering wind, and I'll come back to that in a second. And then you get this fanfare, da-da-da, and, you know, when he does that on stage, he points the guitar straight towards heaven. It's straight up. You know, it's like this gesture towards this kind of transcendent, like now we're moving to another stage. And there's a whole crafting of energies that's going on with them that you don't need occult language to describe, but from an occult perspective, it makes more sense, and it's deeper and richer. But the point about that line, our stairway lies in the whispering wind, is that this is where you get into the really kind of deeper, more confusing and paradoxical, enigmatic elements of the song. So a lot of the song is about song. There's a songbird that sings. A piper is calling. If we call the tune, you know, we can still hear the tune. The stairway lies on the whispering wind. There's all these symbols of song and listening and hearing. And what you kind of start to realize is that the song is sort of about the song. It's about the ability to make a song that's essentially a spell. And the sign of the spell is not like it's turned everybody into, you know, whatever, some, you know, magical people or fairies or crazy killers or whatever you, whatever fantasy is. It's just the fact that it's like number one. I mean, that's it. That's the number one rock song from the 70s. It will always be the number one rock song from the 70s. It made these guys huge amount of money. And there's a kind of self-referentiality to the song that I think is very, actually quite powerful, because they're really talking about the power of music and the way that we give ourselves to music, the way that it offers a kind of rapture, and that, you know, that rapture is something very much that keeps people coming back to their music, because there's a particular quality of sort of energetic transformation that they offer as few do. So it's no accident that it's this song where you find these mysterious backwards messages, or what sound like mysterious backwards messages.
Here's to my sweet Satan, right?
You know, because that's a whole, it's almost, it's not like they put them there. It's not like they're not there at all. It's like in this space where there's enchantment and power and lust and money and electronic collective consciousness, all of these things are weaving through this one song. So it's perfectly appropriate on that kind of synchronistic level that if you go listening for these things in this song, you will hear something. You know, if somebody says, look, what you're about to hear is going to sound like, you know, here's to my sweet Satan, or there's no escaping it, or whatever, you'll probably hear it. I mean, and it's not that those messages are, quote-unquote, really there. It's just that there's this kind of richness and density to this song that almost inevitably makes phantasms arise. So it ends up being a very enigmatic track, that one. It's it stands up, even though we're all kind of sick of it on some level.
Well, one of the songs on the album that is less popular, but one that I really, really like, is Four Sticks.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I also did not, I used to not like that track, and then I just decided it was great, and in listening to it over and over again. There's a whole way in which it kind of feeds into the sort of story of this one guy's journey. You know, he kind of goes through and he has the transcendental experience, that is Stairway to Heaven, and then he's got to spend the whole second side of the records like figuring out what to do, and he's still wandering, he's still restless. He realizes that, you know, the great mystical experience doesn't necessarily answer the problem of how you live your life or how you deal with people or how you deal with desire, which is all the stuff that kind of happens on the second record, where he continues to wander. He's in the first Misty Mountain Hop. He's like, oh, I got to get out of here. I got to get to the Misty Mountains. And then, you know, Four Sticks is where he kind of, you know, he tries to go to the Misty Mountains. He tries to go mystic. He tries to get back there. And the sound of the song has all these subtle bits of what you call Orientalism to it. It's like it has these elements of sort of Eastern music. He Plant always described his vocals as a kind of raga kind of thing, and it's really a song of a kind of attempt at a spiritual journey, but it's a weird one. It's sort of foreclosed. It's kind of dark. It doesn't quite work. The lyrics are a little spooky, and the sound of it is kind of dense and compact. You know, he's striving upwards. That riff is going up, like he's climbing up a mountain. He's trying to get somewhere, but where? It's not really clear. Not really clear at all. It gets kind of stuck. So it ends up being one of the most kind of fascinating songs on the record, because it's like a knot of energy, and it's really compressed. I mean, even literally, like the way that the vocals are.
Well, I think we could spend a whole lot of time on each song and talking about even more of the symbolism of the album. And
yeah, there's a lot more. That's why it was so much fun to be able to have the space to write about it in the book, because I got to really go into all this stuff, and it was very satisfying and fun.
Well, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I definitely will shortly. And I'll also have a link to it to the Amazon page so that people listening to the podcast can come to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on that and order it from the Amazon page. What do you have a personal website?
Yes, it's called technosis.com, www.technosis.com.
And if people have questions or anything, they can email you directly?
Yeah.
All right, fantastic. Again, I would love to speak more. It's just we do have time constraints.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So I hope this is a good teaser about what's in the book, and
yeah,
people will definitely go out there and order it.
Excellent.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it, Eric.
Well, thank you.
Once more, we come to the end of another show. I hope you have enjoyed it and found it interesting. If you have, please tell your friends about the show and possibly consider linking to it on your blog or website. At the bottom of the Thelema Coast to Coast website, you'll see a banner for the show. Feel free to use it and link back to the site. I don't ask for financial support, but word of mouth is very welcome. Also, the feedback I received is much appreciated. You can email podcast@thelemacoastacoast.com or visit the blog and leave a comment at www.thelemacoastacoast.com. The closing song is called Green Lights and is by the band Alchemist Element. I think they sound a lot like Tool, so I'm hoping that you all like them. If you do like them, go to their website and listen to the rest of their songs and watch their videos. Also email them and say you heard their songs on Thelema Coast to Coast. At any rate, here's the song. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you tune in to the next show. Love's the law, love under will.